listening to a Radio Geekly. Good morning, Rose City. Welcome to another exciting episode of a Radio Geekly. I'm just Jess, and I am joined in the studio by some of our collective members. I have Conch, hello. Kyle, and David here in the studio. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, all.
Good to see you.
Good morning.
Happy Friday. How are you all doing on this quite hazy day, I have to say?
Hazy for not so great reasons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Something is on fire.
The big thing is on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're on fire here in the studio.
Wow. Starting off strong here. Well, we just want to welcome all of you to another episode that we are going to discuss about comics and zines. Three of us here went to the zine symposium over, was it 2 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. And got to talk on a panel. Our panel was titled Comics as Resistance. And we got to kind of give our insights and just what we interpret as comics in the form of resistance and just zines in general. But I wanted to kind of hear before we play a segment that talks about the actual panel and the zine discussion. What were your takeaways from the symposium?
Well, it was an incredibly supportive environment. There was a table out in the main area that was the zine emergency table.
And I visited that table.
If you didn't bring your own supplies, there were markers and glue and paper and everything, and I think a saddle stitcher, a stapler, all the stuff that you needed. And besides our panel, there was another really supportive panel about trying to get affordable creative spaces in this town and thereabouts. And our city commissioner, Chloe Udaly, was one of the panelists on that.
Oh, very cool.
And I visited I was there on Saturday, but not on Sunday. And I visited, I'm pretty sure, every table there. And there's just like a wide variety of things people offer. Like some just like created their own zines. Other people had like photography projects and anthologies. And I liked the wide variety that zines can offer, I suppose. And that was at the symposium.
Yeah. And the variety of topics too. I think there mm-hmm. there was no kind of rules and regulations in terms of like what you can write a zine about.
It was no table seemed to be able to fit into one category.
Right.
That was, yeah, it was very nuanced.
Yeah. That was very awesome. And it was over at the Apano Center, which was, I like that nice open space. It kind of felt that you can walk around and be free to just browse and look and actually talk to the artists. I think mm-hmm. a lot of times at conventions, you don't get that opportunity to talk with people. And I know Conch, you and I were able to stop at a couple booths and talk with folks. And
yeah, it reminded me a little bit of the, they haven't had this year, unfortunately, the line work event, which is a great comics and poster and mm-hmm. illustration festival, and there used to be a big Artists Alley Fest. I don't know if that's going to happen this year at the Sprightly Bean. So it was really good to have this event where artists can really meet their avid readers and make more avid readers.
Yeah, that was really cool. David, I know you wanted to kind of pitch in on your thoughts on zines and comics. Have you always been a comic book reader, or what drew you into wanting to talk about comics?
I'm a little late in the game for the comic thing, so I've been kind of picky. I'm able to look at, you know, what the years of popularity and what's risen to the top. So in some ways, I'm sort of a snob on that end. But what I do like about the zines is that anyone can get into the game. Mm-hmm. And the circulation is always, I mean, you can just be a kook who has a photocopier and you're able to hand out your old pamphlets or whatever you want to do to whoever's willing to take them, and you're a zine publisher, and that's part of the magic of it. Anyone can do it, and you can talk about whatever you want, no matter how much it clashes against what everyone else wants to say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I know we were also talking about like quality of content too, and so like anybody that has a printing machine or can go to a print maker, you know, let's stop off at Kinko's or whatever and make copies of things, can make a zine. But I think that's also the beauty of it, having that grassroots mentality, that you don't have to have this nice glossy shrink-wrapped, you know, art form in terms of actually printing a zine. You can just make it on the, you know, in the comforts of your own home. So that was really cool. Are there any zines that drew you, David, to want to like get more involved in reading more zines, or any artists in particular, or topics?
It would be like where growing up on the whatever, you know, in Nebraska, just someone at the bar is handing out, hey, check this out, and you're like, oh, what is this? And it's just a collage of nonsense. Mm-hmm. Like, this is fascinating. And I think that's what a lot of it is from what I've seen, from where I've gone with that. But sometimes it'd be like poetry, whatever art. It's just someone who wants to have a forum as small scale as it needs to be. Also, I tend to collect chick comics when I find them laying around. Those things are fascinating.
Oh, they're religious tracts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a zine called The Imp that came out a few years ago, and it was profiling different comics artists. And they did one about Jack Chick, and the author called him punk as, and we can't use that word that starts with an F, but Chick was such an influential cartoonist, and people hate, a lot of people hate that whole fundamentalist kind of not very tolerant viewpoint that he had. But at the same time, his stuff got out there in a grassroots way, just ended up in phone booths and at diners and all these things, in a place that, you know, zinesters like us can only wish for.
Mm-hmm. My roommate used to work at a place that did a lot of surveys from hospitals, and people would fill out the surveys and mail it there, and they were like a house that just took everything in, and he'd come home with just piles of piles of chick comics that people would shove in with their surveys, and we get a kick out of them. The art's neat. The story is definitely not necessarily something I agree with, but it's just fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
That's probably not the route we wanted to go with all the other great stuff out there, but that's just something.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think there's a point to the different types of zines, too. They're not all, you know, politically driven. They're not all, you know, trying to create something of like a bias one way or another, but they're just mostly like information. I think it's just the basic information that they want to portray, and they do it in a creative way that I think a lot of times nowadays with the future generations that kind of get lost in that way, that they go to more digital forms of media. So I think we also talked about this in the panel, how zines are still just as important, because there's something about actually having something in your hand and reading it versus looking at a screen. Mm-hmm. And yes, zines are slowly transitioning to be more online, or they actually make two formats. They actually make the print format and then put something online. But yeah, I don't know. There's just something about physically reading something and you're like, you know, holding it in your hand. I don't know.
Zines have a lot in common with posters, too.
Yeah.
And that's, you would see a lot of posters at the Zine Symposium. And you also see that, well, there's a lot of enthusiasm for the IPRC reopening, the Independent Publishing Resource Center, which is now on MLK. It's open. They're going to have a grand opening next month, September 9th, I think. But yeah, it's down in MLK near the Hawthorne Bridge. I think a lot of the people who had the really stylish zines, not just the Kinko copied ones, probably had used some of the machinery there, the letterpress, and you know, there is definitely like a continuum from zines to comics, and somewhere in between those, there's a group in town called Know Your City, and they put out these comics for change, and they were really amazing. They commissioned some great local artists such as Jesse Recklaw of Slow Wave and Ryan Alexander Tanner. And let's see, there was, Hazel Neulevelt. Anyway, these and they had a bunch of writers, including Douglas Wolk, Anne-Marie DiStefano. And they put out I'm thinking zines, but they're really comics about Portland history and Portland activists and people who changed the scene. You know, stories about folks like Walter Cole, who we know as Darcel, and Kathleen Sadat, and Ibrahim Mubarak. So, you know, these projects, I mean, Portland, I don't know about other cities. I don't know about LA or New York or Chicago so much, but Portland is definitely a hotbed of comics for change.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it so great to kind of bring to light things like the Zine Symposium and be one of those voices to get people to hear about the impact that zines are making in our culture and in our society. So I think that was really cool to actually have all of us there, at least the three of us there at the symposium, to talk about comics as resistance Yeah, it was interesting panel. People asked a lot of good questions and stuff too.
I thought we at the panel we kind of touched on a lot of big social issues in terms of like how to connect with people, and I just think we hit those big questions, and I think zines are a great way to connect with people other than online or something like that.
Right. Community building, community radio, it all connects.
Yeah, it is all connected.
It is all connected.
And it's our job to connect it.
Yes, there you go. And with that, why don't we take a listen to the part of our panel from the Zine Symposium. It's myself, Conch, and Kyle talking at the PCC, actually, right across the street from the Apano Center. So let's take a listen to that now.
I'm Just Jess, and I'm joined here by collective members Kyle and Conch.
Hello,
and
hello.
Thank you all for attending this morning's panel on comics as resistance. We're going to be talking a lot about how this artwork, I keep saying genre, but it's actually more of an art form than it is a particular genre. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
So more talking about this art form and how it is used in activism, protests, and overall resistance. So before we dig into some of those avenues, why don't each of you take a moment to kind of describe comics and your thoughts about what that looks like to use an art form like comics and graphic novels and zines in particular to either push an agenda or inform people about a certain ideal.
Well, I guess what sparked my curiosity about it was, I guess, probably a month after the election, like some of these anthology collections started to start these open submission things. Like Resist is a big one. They called for submissions in like December, and then they passed out their newspapers on Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C., and passed them out in comic shops throughout the city. And there's another anthology that also accepted submissions around the same time, Comics for Choice, which is the pro-choice anthology, which either just came out or is coming out this summer. So what's fascinating about it is just like how under political turmoil, I think the comics medium just like knew how to clock into gear, unlike other mediums that were kind of more left scrambling. So I just think that there's something inherent in the medium that like makes it adaptable to current events and political commentary and turmoil. And I think that's definitely worth dissecting or figuring out at least.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to go along with Kyle. Definitely. Here in Portland, we have some amazing people who are putting community together. Tanika Stotts, who is down in San Diego right now, the Comic-Con is going on the same weekend as the Zine Symposium, has put together some great anthologies of black cartoonists. We've got other groups who are doing that through crowdfunding and through just like-minded individuals. I'm kind of a history geek. Any other history geeks in the room, I totally recommend the first weekend of August, heading down to Silverton if you have wheels. There's an event called the Homer Davenport Days, and it's a commemoration of Homer Davenport, this Oregon-based cartoonist, political cartoonist, who became just exceptionally famous at the turn of the last century for taking on the moneyed interests.
And here we are back at the in studio here. We're talking about comics and the Zine Symposium. That was just a little segment that we produced at down at the PCC Southeast Campus during the Portland Zine Symposium on July 22nd. But I was going to kind of talk to you guys about the comics as forms of resistance. And one thing that was kind of drawing for me was the fact that a lot of times zines and early comics, from my understanding, I mean, I'm not a professional by any means. My knowledge of comics is very, very limited. But I always thought it was fascinating how some of the early comics were used as like morale boosters for the military, for like serving during war-torn times, and they would get sent, you know, their care packages and all that kind of stuff, and then have these comics in there. And it's interesting how a lot of the initial comics were sent in like a positive light of like hope and like there is going to be a better tomorrow kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now there's a difference in like there needs to be change. And so I always thought it was fascinating how the drive for zines has been more about giving more of information rather than like, it's going to be okay, like being more empathetic or sympathetic to to the current situation, but actually addressing the issues.
Well, I think there are some zines that exist that are that have the it's going to be okay mentality, because a lot of people, I guess with a lot of political turmoil going on now, a lot of people are trying to just trudge on. So I think there's a lot of that. And also with a lot of anthologies that come out, like we talked about this in the panel, but I'm thinking of Resist, Comics for Change, Comics for Choice. It really captures the zeitgeist of what people are feeling under the political and social duress.
Right.
Yeah. There are also a lot of great therapeutic comics, like where people just put out the problems that they've been having personally. You see a lot of really fascinating comics about, you know, depression, anxiety, the personal things that people go through. And it's great for connecting and saying, hey, you know, you're not the only one. Here we are. Let's you know, be real and honest about our situation.
Yeah, and I like that we can use that platform for zines as like a form of honesty. Like, again, there's little guidelines and rules, and kind of turn. I don't know what I'm trying to say. There's more freedom, I guess, to kind of talk about what you want in zines than there is like in other kind of forms of media.
And it's a great, well, you know, people think of it, some people think of it as like a farm team for stepping up. Other people just do it their whole lives, you know, but yeah, some people, they actually are so successful that that they end up being some major comics publisher says, boy, we really like your stuff. It's connecting with a lot of people. Let's add you to our bullpen or whatever.
Right.
Now, one thing about that is, some publishers, not necessarily referring to independent publishers, but I guess also corporate publishers, it's like, hey, we like the message you're sending, but it's not always something that represents the voice of the people. So what I like about anthologies that collect a bunch of different voices is that it captures what the people are saying. It's like that collectiveness we were talking about earlier that has a lot to do with it.
And I even when we were talking with some people in the panel, that one in particular, they were a zine artist themselves, and they said that they felt better as like giving their voice in this art form because there was that freedom and that capability to bring communities together and to bring information to more people.
Yeah.
And it was like empowering in a way to allow this platform for zines to create this content and to distribute it out freely so people can be aware or informed about upcoming topics and things like that.
Yeah, that was Liz Yerby, who is also one of the organizers for the Zine Symposium and who I was in touch with for the panel. And yeah, they do a lot of good stuff, a lot of good queer comics, and a lot of autobio stuff that's pretty thought-provoking.
Shout out to Liz.
Yeah. Thanks, Liz. We appreciated your time in helping us make the panel happen. I'm just getting word from our mighty, mighty board operator that we have an alternate part of this segment from the Zine Symposium that we can play. And so we're going to take that and listen to it, and we'll come back and talk more about comics and zines.
Newspapers. And so these mass media productions got all the way around the country, and they told people what was going on in politics, and there were some really scathing cartoons. And even, you know, going back further to the early days of the printing press, there were cartoons that were circulated. You could call them comics now, but they were pictures with words and captions, and they really riled up the masses and did a lot to get rid of monarchies and a lot of noble overlords and the things that were sort of running the countries at the time. So it's a totally different scene now. Of course, we have the web, but we have zines. And another thing that's wonderful about this town, about Portland, is that zines and small press materials get into the libraries. There's a shop where the library gets rid of its old stuff called Tidal Wave. So I totally recommend if you want to get at some old zines, especially from local authors, go down to Tidal Wave in Northeast Portland and check out what's in their bins, because there's an amazing variety, and a lot of it is from people who otherwise don't get published by the major author, by the major houses.
I was curious when you were talking about historically, Conch, with how some of these political cartoons and things were being displayed kind of in mass publications. My understanding from a lot of these comics that actually got published were to kind of give like encouragement and hope to like the soldiers fighting overseas. You know, they would get the editions of Captain America and Superman and, you know, trying to bring a little bit of light into the darkness, you know, during a war-torn world. And so why do you think that shift kind of happened to like push that, you know, a certain political agenda instead of having comics be some sort of like lighthearted print to kind of give a little bit of glimmer of like, oh, there is a better day out tomorrow?
Yeah, even in the early days of the newspaper strip, we don't think of it now because so many newspaper strips are about suburban families or talking animals.
Right.
There's still some great stuff out there. Gary Trudeau, of course, with Doonesbury is still going strong. Nicole Hollander with Sylvia, fantastic strip. There's Oregon's own Jan Elliott with Stone Soup, which has done some scathing stuff about universities and governments getting all this funding while poor kids get second-class schooling. But in the early days, yeah, the first cartoons were really about the squalid conditions in cities, and they had great stuff about Depression-era characters trying to make do and going up against landlords, greedy landlords, and, you know, factory bosses. I mean, it really was kind of like the old jester kicking the king kind of stuff. And some of it was very radical. And, yeah, a lot of this became very adult content. Soldiers overseas used to be really happy to get comics. And after World War II, that continued for a little while, but immediately, and a lot of people blame the McCarthy era. Let's see, one guy in particular, Seduction of the Innocent, I'm trying to remember his name, Dr. Frederick Wortham, sparked these hearings in Congress about these terrible, violent, and sexually themed comics, these themes like homosexuality that were going to corrupt our children. Mm. And so the comics industry, in order to avoid government censorship, came up with their own comics code. And that's the reason why, for a long time, you had this idea that comics were only for kids because the content was subject to self-censorship. And, of course, it took about 10 or 15 years for that to blow up with underground comics when those came along in the late 60s and 70s. But, yeah, I don't know if we've ever shaken off the idea that comics and animation in this country are just supposed to be family-friendly because we had that political agenda that lasted for so long.
I think this may be a stretch or not, but I think the way more other forms of media, widespread media, is kind of perceives comics as more of like a downtrodden medium. Like, I think recently it's more of an exception because there are a lot of franchises that are behind it. There was a guest on the KBOO News on Tuesday, I think, who was part of the Zine Symposium that said that, like, you see a new article about zines are coming back every year because that's, like, a general perception of it. So maybe it's just, like, a lot of, like, more scathing critiques are found in comics because, like, it comes from that, if that makes sense, or is that a stretch?
No, I think that makes sense. So kind of seeing as it getting more pushback.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, actually being a true art form and, like, credible.
Yeah, and just, like, dismissing it as low art, which I don't agree with in any stretch of the imagination. So I think maybe that plays a part in it.
I'm going to recommend that anybody check out some of the British editorial cartoons, because these guys are just, American editorial cartoons have gotten kind of mild in comparison to how they used to be. Folks like Pat Oliphant back in the day, the 70s and 80s. If you look at somebody like Steve Bell or Martin Rosen over in The Guardian or The Independent or these British newspapers, Steve Bell is not only just wicked, just his stuff is just so wonderfully insulting, but he also will take off on these old masters' paintings. He'll have the British politicians, the American politicians, you know, in these scenes that are from a Turner painting or a Constable painting or something like that. And I love how, you know, newspaper readers and
in England have enough cultural background that they can, yeah, they can get, well, it's kind of like if we had Washington crossing the Delaware, I think, with a bunch of fighting politicians on there. But yeah, I think there's a lot of appreciation of the high art, low art mashup that goes on in Europe more than you see in the U.S.
I think Calvin and Hobbes has some great high art and low art commentary behind it. I'm trying to think of the one strip that they did. It was just like, oh, what are you doing? I'm drawing a comic. Oh, is that low art? And it's just like, no. And it's just like, oh, well, if that was in a frame or a painting in a museum, that'd be high art. It's just like, I guess so. But it's just like, I don't know, I forget the specifics of the strip. But it was like, there's some commentary in that in Calvin and Hobbes that Watterson did.
I always got a little pissed off at Roy Lichtenstein because his paintings were never as good as the actual cartoonist.
I agree with that. It's just like a very like close zoom up of a really profound good comic. Yeah, I see that.
But he actually didn't have the mastery. This is what, you know, we're only appreciating now. If you look back and somebody like Wally Wood or Jack Kirby had just these stunning chops, these incredible talents, and they would just turn out the stuff mass-produced. It's kind of like how we appreciate the engravings of the old Victorian era.
Yeah, it's the same techniques and mechanisms, but it's perceived differently.
And they were just considered workers back then. Mm-hmm. You know, the engravers were considered journeymen.
Do you think with that, those types of positions, that you think they would have some more artistic freedom to create content, pushing the envelope that was more politically forward because they were kind of in the background? They didn't necessarily have their name out there in mass media, so people knew, like, oh, I know this is Jack Kirby before Jack Kirby became who he was. With those certain artists that they were like, well, a lot of people don't really know. I'm just hired to do this. So they kind of have that little extra to kind of go forward.
I'm going to say there's a lot of subtext back then. What do you think?
Mm. Yeah, I'd say that. That would make sense. What I thought of when you said that was Egyptian workers or slaves were writing hieroglyphs within pyramids on the back. They'd make hieroglyphs insulting the pharaoh. And people didn't find out about them until the bricks fell off. And that's technically the first form of like sequential art satire. So that's what it made me think of when you were saying that, about how like they were just kind of like workers like with grievances.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, literally written in stone.
Yeah, it's, yeah, exactly.
Literally.
Yeah.
Carved in stone.
And I do think also that especially like in the 20th century, early 20th century, there were a lot of publishers who were happy to have cartoonists who disagreed with them. You know, I was mentioning Homer Davenport earlier. He worked for the Hearst newspapers. You know, Hearst was not exactly an enlightened guy during the era of the 20s and 30s, but he was happy to hire people who had very radical views and would put them forth in his papers. And I don't know if you see that nowadays.
It's more. It seems to be more along the lines of like a digital age. I guess with that, it kind of seems like zines, like you were saying, Kyle, kind of makes a comeback in print. And as we're moving forward into the, you know, 21st century, why would it seem to be more prevalent to actually have printed materials of protest, of resistance, of controversy, basically? Why is it so important to actually have a tangible object in someone's hand versus referring to a website or referring to something on the internet?
I think a big part of it is less of a corporate filter, because like a lot of zines and small press are self-published, so it's coming straight from the creator's mind and soul and straight into your hands, essentially. I'm trying to remember the specifics of it, but like DC and Marvel take up 80% of the industry, and then Image and Dark Horse take up like almost 20%. So that small percentage is like where I think all the best comics are, like all the small press, everything that you don't see enough of, except for, you know, places like Portland, other spots in the Northwest, or other zine symposiums.
Mm-hmm. I've got a number of zines here that are, well, one of them is the Prison Correspondence Project.
You want to pass those around?
Oh, sure. Oh. There's some great historical stuff here. You know, one of the problems that people forget is that the internet, you know, anything having to do with computers can still be a little bit classist. You sure you can go to, if you have a great library system in your county like we do here in Portland, in Multnomah County. You can go to the library and access the internet. You know, otherwise, if you want the most up-to-date computer with the current software and everything like that, it's going to cost money. Internet access is going to cost you money at home. It's going to cost a lot more than it does in other countries. Mobile devices are kind of bridging the gap a little bit. But yeah, being able to have something physical that you can pass out at a rally is still a great thing. Having something that people can take from a vestibule of your favorite coffee shop or or radio station, that's a cool thing. You know, a lot of excuses get made by people with the major print media that say, well, you know, we have this one view, but you have the internet. You know, everything is so dispersed on the internet, and it's not always easy to access. It's not every place that you get great internet access and are in a position to get on the web. So yeah, there is still definitely a place for print media.
I think, yeah, zines are a great way to bypass the internet. I think it was, I guess this kind of goes towards how zines and comics can be reflective of current like events that happen that affect a lot of people. Like I remember when Snowden gave out those NSA leaks to those journalists, there were some zines that came out specifically on internet security, like how to use Tor without being detected by the government, and how to just adjust your privacy settings on Facebook, because if you're paranoid about your internet privacy, why go on the internet for that?
And analog media, let's also give a shout out to radio.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, KBOO, of course, streams on the web, but you can also just go into a thrift store and get a $5 radio set, analog radio set, plug it in, and you're not being tracked. You're listening to any radio station you want. Nobody's got your ISP. We get a lot of listeners in prison, and I know one of the zines that I'm passing around here is from the Prison Access Project. You know, they don't get internet access for the most part in prison. So again, print media is great. Radio is great for folks who are incarcerated or in places where they have limited liberties.
I know, Kyle, you were mentioning how there was less kind of either governmental interference, less kind of corporate interference when it comes to zines and printed materials. Would you like to elaborate maybe on like why that is so important when it comes to things like pushing resistance, pushing activism, pushing social justice?
I mean, I think the biggest benefit, in my opinion, would just be that it doesn't tamper with the message. It doesn't water it down to any degree. It's just coming straight from the creator to the person reading it. Since you're just getting it at a comic shops that the creator delivers to it, or just from conventions and symposiums, there's also less of a filter of distribution that obstructs that as well.
So so more of like a peer-to-peer interaction is
yeah,
a little
precisely.
More,
it's just second to word of mouth, honestly. And I think that's a very reliable thing that shouldn't be taken for granted, and something that might be kind of diminished in internet and social media, even though it's still very open, but there is some classist vibes to it. And not to digress, but that's also one of the reasons why I'm worried about net neutrality. Like, that's one of the strongholds to keeping the internet as open as it is, even though it's still not as open as it could be or as open as distributing print media hand to hand.
I see that as like the generations where you see the memes of everybody's on their phone, and you know, I'm the perfect example right here with our phone playing our theme song. In terms of actual like communication, there seems to be a barrier between actual interaction, and I think in the future, and this is just my observation, that future generations are going to lose that connectivity of actual like face-to-face conversation with people because they're so focused on screens and interacting and creating a persona. So I think in terms of like printed materials and actual like handing out of these zines to people and having those conversations is really important, and I'm really glad that these zines are kind of making this comeback, because it seems like we're losing our general social cues a lot of times because we're just becoming more robotic.
Yeah, I'm really glad the Zine Symposium is still around because it's the antidote to alienation, and it's true that the picture of everybody on their own phone is kind of is an image of alienation. Although I suppose, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, everybody had their nose in a newspaper. It's kind of more than that. It's kind of more than just being on the bus or on the train. It's like even just going down the street, even being in a coffee shop. I think people are crying out for a place where it's okay to be interactive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. At some point, I'd love to sort of open things up and get more interactive, speaking of that, see what people in their room think.
And we did take the time to ask some Q&A from the people in the panel, but you're going to have to wait to listen to it at a later date because we're going to leave you hanging here and actually post it up onto the KBOO website in the future where you can hear our Q&A segment from the Portland Zine Symposium. Hey, everyone out there in the Rose City, this is just Jess. You're listening to a Radio Geekly. I've got Kyle, Conch, and David here in the studio. We're talking about zines, and we want to bring another voice into the discussion. We've got Ben Charbonneau on the line. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Doing awesome. Thanks for taking the time out to talk with us this morning. And for folks that don't know about your work, why don't you discuss a little bit about your involvement with like the comics and the zines?
Sure. Yeah. So I work for Scout Books, and we make, you know, tiny environmentally friendly pocket-sized notebooks. Very similar to a zine, but a little bit different. And a few months ago, we released a book called We the People Are Powerful, a visual guide to understanding your civil liberties. I did a lot of the development of content in that, and we worked with some local artists to really illustrate that, and it is exactly what it sounds like, a pocket-sized guide to sort of understanding your rights and your liberties as a citizen, as a resident in Portland.
After you published We the People, did anyone come up to you afterwards and tell you how that book really benefited them and their ways of activism?
I don't know about that directly, but we did get a ton of feedback from different organizations around the city that they found it to be a really useful tool to give the people that frequent their businesses or organizations. We made some contacts with City Hall and with some local representatives, particularly Chloe Udaly and Earl Blumenauer. We're, you know, getting ready to start planning to do a reprint of it and hopefully expand a little bit more and be able to reach out to more people.
Now, I heard that you've been working pretty closely with Portland and Multnomah County's congressional rep, Earl Blumenauer, and also former Reading Frenzy owner Chloe Udaly turned city commissioner. So what can you tell us about their involvement?
Absolutely, yeah. With Chloe Udaly's office, she was pretty much the first elected official we had contacted. Polly Ann Burge, who works in her office, is a mentor of mine. And so I approached her when we were putting the book together and asked if, we would be able to put some of these books in Chloe's office and hopefully she would be able to, hand them out to constituents. And from that relationship, we were connected with Earl Blumenauer's office, and now we're working with them to sort of expand the project a little bit more and to hopefully be in touch with other officials so we can really just reach a broader audience.
You mentioned Polly Ann Burge. She used to be the head of the IPRC, Independent Publishing Resource Center, and now she's the director of communications, I believe, for Chloe Udaly's office at City Hall.
Absolutely. And that's actually at the IPRC is where we met. We met when she, I think, was still doing the volunteer coordinator position, and I was a volunteer. And things sort of naturally just grew from there.
And that's awesome that you mention it, Ben, because we actually have Polly Ann on the line. Good morning, Polly Ann.
Hi. Well, I just want to maybe make a quick correction. I am not the director of communication. That would be terrific. But I'm actually the community engagement and policy advisor for Commissioner Hugh Daly.
Thanks for the correction.
Yeah, no problem.
What kind of work does that entail?
You know, it's a really fun job, and I get to do, it's kind of a mix match of a lot of stuff, but it's a lot outward facing things. So I get to work on things to do with arts and culture. You know, the Commissioner Hugh Daly has a couple of really big bureaus. One is the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and the other one is Bureau of Development Services. So I will often liaison with especially ONI, Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and constituents, but also I think part of my charge is really to be able to translate some of the policy work that we do into understandable bites for the public. And I'm really excited about that, especially with the nature of this conversation around how do we use arts and culture and comic books and illustrations to talk about the big monolithic bureaus of the city of Portland.
And that's a project that you're undertaking at the moment. It's in the early stages, so I guess we won't talk too much about it, but you've got high hopes for it.
I really do, you know, and Ben was so lovely. We met early on, right after the November election, to talk about, you know, I think I've been an advocate in talking about how do we use arts and culture to articulate government operations. And so in talking with Ben, he said, you know, kind of sit down and spitball a little bit about what this might look like for Scout Books. And then I went off and as a volunteer helped with Chloe's campaign, and you know, we won, which is great. And Ben was able to come and gather people and make an incredible, very dynamic piece in We the People, Our Powerful Scout Book. So it's been really lovely in that way to have that collaborative relationship. And for me, I feel like this is a really terrific model to think about how do I approach my work here with articulating what the Office of Neighborhood Involvement does, what the city in general does, how the bureaus work, because I really feel like if folks knew a bit more about how things worked at the municipal level, they would have a better effectiveness in making change, because there'd be an education component that was exciting. And I recently heard a quote, forgive me, I'm forgetting the person who said it, but it was, you know, artists make the revolution irresistible. Mm. And I feel like in some ways, we need to make city government's kind of outward-facing effort irresistible through arts and culture. I feel like so many people are apathetic because they don't know how, understand how it works. And to kind of say that you don't understand how it works, make you in a vulnerable position. Why not just make it fun to learn how things work so people can engage more effectively?
Very well said. And so, Ben, where can folks look for the We the People book, or where are you handing them out? Is there going to be any more events or anything that people can get their hands on it?
Well, unfortunately, we have passed out our bulk of them.
Which is actually a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. You know, I definitely didn't expect the success to be this wide, and it's amazing. So now we're really focusing on trying to get the funding to do, you know, a reprint of it, and also work on a translation.
Yeah. And that's, I think, something the city's really interested in, is using some of these materials and being able to translate them into other languages and making them accessible online and things like that, too.
That's wonderful. And, Polly, what else can you kind of give us in terms of things to look forward to from Mrs. Hugh Daly's kind of campaign in terms of bringing more information to the people in forms of, like, artwork and culture?
Well, you know, I feel like Commissioner Hugh Daly really was able to set the tone with her actual political campaign by using Joe Sacco and doing a campaign piece that was absolutely unique and innovative in the way that we approached it.
The Renter's Rights comic.
That's absolutely right. And I think so often these campaign pieces are an over oversized postcard, glossy picture of somebody putting their thumbs up going, I care. And this piece from Joe Sacco that Chloe, you know how it was structured, was Commissioner Udaly actually went out and interviewed different people that were facing evictions or different pieces of the rental crisis and built this comic on their words. And so I think it really resonated with people because they saw their lived experience in this comic book far more than an oversized glossy postcard. So what I really want to do, again, is try to open the doors to City Hall through arts and culture. We have a couple things coming up, our more performative pieces. But September 8th here on campus, we're going to be working with Friends of Noise, which is an advocacy group around youth involvement in producing music, not only playing music, but the back end of production and curatorial stuff and whatnot. And that'll be right here at City Hall. And again, that's also a way to highlight the youth in our community doing great work and the organization. And we're going to be having tabling, talking about what the city does to try to, you know, kind of get folks on board. And then something I'm really excited about, which we haven't really talked about it publicly yet, but there's a band, Dead Moon. You're probably familiar with Dead Moon. But there's a system, we don't have a keys to the city of Portland, but we have a thing called a proclamation. And we are putting together a Dead Moon proclamation, kind of highlighting our punk elders, and having an event here on October 5th. I really think it's so important to both highlight the amazing cultural landscape we have here in Portland, as well as using that toolkit to bring people inside, kind of almost attract them with arts and culture, and then once they're in the mix, be able to talk more freely and openly about how the city of Portland works, how the bureaus work. So I really feel like that's that lack of education, that civics 101, that's why We the People Are Powerful is so important, is that people don't want to admit what they don't know. And I think if we were able to give people this very basic understanding of how things work, they're far more likely to get involved, particularly in this really interesting period of human history, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Ben Charbonneau and Pollyann Birch, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and your busy schedules to talk to us about your involvement in the comics and zine scene and how it's been impacting our culture here in Portland. So thank you so much, and we'll hopefully you guys enjoy the hotness by staying cool in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely.
Or just jump in the river.
Thank you so much. And just one last thing is we're really excited about KBOO's 50th anniversary, and we've already been talking about leadership there, about possibly doing something here at City Hall to celebrate that. So we're definitely in partnership with you guys. Thank you so much for what you do.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's awesome. I love how we can kind of connect people actually using zines to make a change directly here in our city.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's been awesome to hear. So thanks, Pollyann and Ben for that. So as we kind of wrap up here talking about comics and zines and things, one thing that I've always known about with the comics and zines kind of genre is the fact that it could bring people together, but it also can take you to a different place. Imagination and creativity can be so vast and so expansive that you can kind of get away and kind of check out for a while. And a lot of times that kind of engulfs itself into the genres of fantasy and science fiction and just pure adventure. And so as we close out this discussion on comics and zines, I kind of wanted to highlight a little bit about what we're going to talk about next month, and that's the Star Trek just fandom. That means all sorts of Trekkies coming down to discuss their ideals and information in terms of what they like about Star Trek, which is their favorite series, because there are several out, and now going to be upcoming a new series, Star Trek Discovery. And this weekend just so happens to be the 30th anniversary of Star Trek The Next Generation. And
my favorite.
And
wow.
There is a convention going on in Las Vegas, and we have an exclusive insight into the convention right now. One of our collective members, Godiva, is on the line. Hello, Godiva. Good morning.
Good morning.
You sound so bright and chipper. How are you feeling in this Star Trek experience?
Sorry, we're on our way to go have brunch with a Nana visitor. We got invited by Gaze of Space, who I actually got an interview with. And I guess Nana visitor hosted every year. She was Major Kira on Deep Space Nine. And I've gotten introduced by a lot of people. Randy Frank is the guy that runs Gaze of Space. And he introduced me to Chase Masterson. I got an interview with her about her nonprofit that she does against bullying and pop culture. I'm having a lot of fun. It's a little overwhelming, but it's great.
Sounds like fun.
Well, yeah. So are you what is one thing that you're looking forward to if you haven't already experienced it?
I'm looking forward to, in about 2 minutes, eating pancakes with Nana Visitor. That's about... I can't imagine doing anything else besides that.
So are you going to be there all weekend?
Yeah, I'm going to be there until it shuts down, and then I'm going to relax at a hostel down the road for a couple of days, and then I'll head back home.
Awesome.
And yeah, it started getting really packed. It was already pretty packed during Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and now it's just people keep coming in. It's crazy.
So have you seen any fun cosplay, or are you actually in cosplay?
I tried. I was going to be Punk Spock, but I just didn't have the energy to make a new leather jacket for that. But some of the gals that I'm with, one of them has a sign around her neck, Josie, that says, I think kid wouldn't make it into Starfleet. And then I've got another one who's doing a cosplay. There was an episode where Ezra Dax in Deep Space Nine has to go deep undercover in the Holo program with Vic Fontaine, and she's dressed like a cigarette girl. So there's a Trill dressed like a cigarette girl that I'm hanging out with, Dylan. I saw somebody who had, what was that, rock monster in the original series?
Okay.
They had a remote control rock monster that they were navigating like a little remote control car.
Wow.
That was pretty cool. Yeah, people are really getting into it.
That's awesome. And so you're going to get some interviews and content from the con floor, I assume.
Oh, yeah.
And report back for our next episode.
Yep, I'm interviewing as many celebrities as I can get a hold of. I am waiting until the weekend really starts up to really see the cosplayers who got really into it, and I want to interview them to see how much detail they put into it. I've been interviewing the people at the booth who have so much to say about different events that started because of Star Trek, different organizations. So it's going to be a lot of stuff.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks for taking the time out. I know you got to get run into eat some pancakes with famous people.
And be sure to thank everybody in Las Vegas for sending their summer weather our way.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's actually just as hot here as it is in Portland right now.
Oh, man. Yeah, I believe it. Well, thanks, Godiva. Have fun, and we look forward to reporting back for our September episode.
All right. Live long and prosper, guys.
See ya. Awesome. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us on this episode of A Radio Geekly. And before we close out, I wanted to give us some upcoming events to look forward to for the month of August. The sci-fi comedy Visit to a Small Planet by Gore Vidal is going to be playing at the Lakewood Center for the Arts in Lake Oswego until August the 13th. Information can be found at lakewood-center.org. On August 19th, the Oregon Bigfoot Festival is going on at the Glen Otto Park in Troutdale.
Oh, I love the Sasquatch Festival.
I hear Bigfoot's going to make an appearance this year.
Ooh.
He's been blowing it off for the past several decades.
He's holding
but this
out.
Time, yeah.
I wonder whatever happened to the Western Bigfoot Society. They used to have a headquarters in St. John's.
Oh, really?
Back in the 90s, yes.
Oh, wow. Maybe they still exist, or there could be some new iteration
right.
of it. Yeah. Info about that festival can be found at OregonBigfootFestival.weebly.com. On the same weekend, August 19th and 20th, the BrickFest Live Lego Fan Experience is happening at the Portland Expo Center. For all of you fans of Lego, join us. I'm looking forward to actually hoping to attend because I am a fan of Lego. And I just found out, and I'm just so excited about this, that they're building a Lego house in Denmark. that you can actually go to. That it's not like Legoland, but it's an actual like
is it like a livable house, like,
full scale?
It's most likely going to be just like a full scale like model that you can be in. And
okay, I was hoping.
I think full scale for like children though.
I was hoping that there would be inner piping made of Lego.
Yeah,
that'd be revolutionary.
It could be.
I heard one of the highlights of the Brickfest in Seattle was a 9-foot-tall Multnomah Falls.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, so that's going on August 19th and 20th. Info is at events.brickfestlive.com. And on August 21st, starting at around 10 a.m., there's a little something called the Solar Eclipse happening.
I think the last one was, say, 79 in our
79,
area.
Yes.
So if you're working, go outside. If you're on the road, park your car. Just, you know, I mean, this isn't going to happen again for a while. I mean,
yes.
It's going to cover the sun. Your little moon's going to be there doing its thing. Get your glasses.
Public service announcement. Be sure you have like the Welder's 14 glasses. That's the high end glass that, and get it from a reputable place.
Yes. Check your sources before throwing your money at a pair of glasses.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a lot of places that are given away free. If you can go to the library, they have a lot of viewing things, are giving away glasses for that day. So.
Yeah. And if you don't need to drive down to Yamhill County, don't do it.
I think or you can bike.
Even one of the strip clubs, I think, downtown was giving away viewing glasses.
Oh,
so,
that's nice of them. That's nice. Yeah, I'm
so community-minded.
So community-minded here. Yes, I think I'm going to probably stay in the comfort of my own home, probably watching it from my back deck, although I do need to get glasses. I have prescription sunglasses, but I don't think they will work for this kind of thing.
No, they will not.
Yeah. And I've also heard that you can get some of those viewfinders, so they're not actual glasses, but they're just an actual piece of paper that has the same technology materials in it that you can just hold up to your face.
The kind you make with the Kleenex box.
Well, you can go online and do a little pinhole thing, and that'll reflect onto the ground. And, you know, if you look down, and I've seen this before with partial eclipses, if you're here in Portland where it's like 98%, 99%, you can see the reflection through the trees of little tiny crescents all over the place.
Wow. It's pretty cool. It's going to be exciting. So enjoy, stay safe when you're watching the eclipse. Take the proper precautions, and we will catch you all next month when we talk about Trek and those kind of things, get reports from Godiva. So thank you, Kyle, Conch, and David for joining me in the studio. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Pollyanne and Ben for calling in, and Godiva as well. And yes, stay tuned at noon for Moving on your community radio station here, KBOO Portland. Take care.
Most effective, Your Majesty. Will you destroy this?
Later.
I like to play with things a while.
Before annihilation.